Your time and expertise are valuable, making Focus one of the most important resources to have at work. These days, professionals spend nearly half the work week on written communication, and it can be difficult to stay on task with all the emails and documents you have to get through. With Grammarly as your AI writing partner, you can stay focused and quickly get through your work with relevant real-time suggestions wherever you write. It works across 500,000 apps and websites, so it can help with everything, from brainstorming presentation ideas to sounding more confident and persuasive in emails and reports. For 15 years, Grammarly has offered best-in-class communication support and enterprise-grade security on a business model that doesn't sell your data. 93% of professionals report that Grammarly helps them get more work done. Download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast, episode 115, Oil, Aid, and Human Rights in 20th Century Guatemala, an interview with Richard Balzano. Guatemala is not usually thought of as an oil country. That is, of course, largely because it's not one. Today's interviewee, however, traces the fascinating story of a largely forgotten and largely unrealized oil rush, which threatened to take place there based on a resource which didn't exist, or to put it more precisely, didn't exist in the quantities needed to properly exploit. There is much more to this story, however. Connected to that interest in oil and the desire of US corporations to make profit from it were the games of the Cold War and fears of communism, dictatorship, civil war, and personal ambition. The man who's done the research and who we're talking to today is Richard Balzano. Richard is an assistant professor in the Faculty of Humanities at Simmons University in Boston. His work on this history of oil diplomacy between the US and Guatemala and the relationship between oil, aid, and human rights, which shaped that diplomacy, brings all of this together to tell the complete story of this overlooked episode. So here he is to tell that story. Well, the story takes place in Guatemala. Many of its actors are from the USA. Most notably, it involves successive presidents, their governments, and oil companies. This involvement in Latin America during the Cold War was not uncommon across the region, so could you begin by giving an overall perspective on the US's relationship with Latin America during the Cold War?
The crux of Latin American Cold War history is there's this push to, quote, bring Latin America in from the cold. When you look at the history of the Cold War, it's got a very Manichaean white and black sort of the Western dominated discourse. And, you know, when you teach the global Cold War and you bring the global South into the perspective, all of a sudden, the good guys are not so much the good guys. You know, and the self-determination of states is out the window, and it reeks of colonial hegemony. You know, to quote Greg Grandin, Latin America is the Achilles heel in the hard armor of American virtue. So I think there's been a disdain, an exclusion of Latin America's Cold War outside of the general Cold War discourse. Because, I mean, when you bring it in, all of a sudden, you know, it's hard to sell yourself as the harbinger of freedom and democracy when you're frequently obstructing the self-determination of states. And then it shifts because there's this push within the field, to quote Max Paul Friedman, to retire the puppets, basically, and to move away from that U.S.-backed dictator discourse that dominated Latin Americanists' perspectives or discourse on the region in that time. Which is all fine and good because, you know, the revisionists have chipped away at that for a long time. But as I like to point out, agency should not be conflated with absolution. And you can give all the agency you want to the, you know, colonial collaborators and the people making decisions and repressing populations throughout the hemisphere. But that doesn't absolve Washington from its role in the hemisphere. And so when you look at some of the more recent stuff, you know, I like to caution to beware of Trojan horses. Like, take, for example, Hal Brands wrote A History of Latin America's Cold War. Hal Brands is a grand strategist, and he works for the American Enterprise Institute. So it feels like a washing of the hands in a lot of perspectives for Washington, you know. And on one point, he argued that perhaps the international financial institutions and the debt cartels that indebted many of Latin America's right-wing regimes was a good thing because it brought about the end to those regimes. And it's like, you know, well, actually, the structural adjustments and austerity that was put in place because of that recreated the material conditions that drove people to mobilize and take up arms in the first place. So I think there's part of the picture is missing there. So, you know, beware of Trojan horses in our efforts to retire the puppets, basically, you know. And when we give agency, you know, we need to give agency that doesn't absolve all parties.
The story you tell in your thesis is enmeshed into a complicated global context. So what was happening in Guatemala, the USA, and the world of oil production at the time that you start telling this story?
Sure. So my story begins at the start of the 20th century. The primary focus of my research is in the 1970s and into the 1980s. But with anything, it begins 100 years earlier. When we pick up, say, in the 19-teens, we're looking at a Latin America in which the United States has replaced Britain as the hemispheric hegemon. You could probably credit the First World War for that. But, you know, the Monroe Doctrine finally got a chance to bloom and was reaffirmed by the Roosevelt Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. And so you see the emergence of, in U.S. policy, you see dollar diplomacy, which is buying up the debts of Latin American states that were owed to Europeans, so that Washington, the United States, was the primary debt holder. And you see gunboat diplomacy, which is exactly what it sounds like. I think it was Greg Grandin in Empire's Workshop who made the claim that the United States sent gunboats to Latin American ports between independence and around 1930, I want to say, 6,000 times. So I'm not a counting man, but that's a lot of gunboats in your ports for the supposed harbingers of democracy. The early 20th century is really that period of overt American imperialism, centered mostly in Central America, the Caribbean, frequent U.S. interventions and occupations, and leaving behind weak institutions and brutal national guards that would eventually become the counterinsurgency machines of the Cold War. You know, the Somozas, Nicaragua, the National Guard and Trujillo in the Dominican Republic. So that's what's taken place at the start of the 20th century. You see the emergence of what we would call banana republics, just agriculturally intensive industries in which there is an American financial interest, agricultural interest. You know, you have a very small collaborative class, you know, a holdover from the colonial era, perhaps. Or in Latin America, you had the liberals versus conservatives, not like American liberals and conservatives, but of a completely different but similar fold, and the liberals being that pro-capital, pro-foreign capital class, progressive in a number of elements, but certainly not when it comes to individual rights, or indigenous rights, or individual rights for large swaths of the population. And so that's where we are at the start of the 20th century, up until the 30s, in which the United States adopts the good neighbor policy under Roosevelt, which at that point, the United States said that we're going to play nice in the sandbox and stop frequent interventions as we've done so far. And that lasted a little bit for a few decades, but it was not without different forms of intervention and financial leverage. So that's where we are at the start of the 20th century, where the story takes off. Now, in terms of oil, we as a species are just coming to terms with the value of oil, the military value and the potential economic value of oil as it begins to transform our economy and the way that our society runs, our manufacturing runs, our shipping runs. Oil is on the brink of becoming king. And you see with the mandate system in the Middle East, and you see the British and the French taking on territories that happen to contain vast swaths of oil until they're quote unquote ready for self-determination, which, you know, readiness usually means having a collaborative class that's willing to adopt Western friendly policies. When you get that much, then it's okay. Now you're ready to have a country, but you can have a flag and an anthem, but, you know, colonialism light with a little trademark like a Bud Light, you know, or Coors Light, like colonialism light. You can have a country, but your resources are still ours. And so that's the emergence of oil exploration is beginning to take place in the teens and the 20s. Now, Guatemala is the poster child for Banana Republics. It has the United Fruit Company, which owns, I want to say, approximately 3/4 or more of the land in Guatemala. They have a monopoly on transportation. The government of Guatemala is ostensibly a rubber stamp for the United Fruit Company at this point in time. And Guatemala has a number of U.S.-friendly regimes leading up to, I guess you'd call it their democratic spring. That's a phrase that's in contention. But you see the emergence of elected leaders for the first time, 1945, up until the 1954 coup, the U.S.-backed coup in Guatemala, orchestrated by the CIA. It was the CIA's first coup in Latin America, second overall, only to Iran in another oil-rich region. So where my story picks up is with the earliest exploration of oil in Guatemala and efforts to control the legislation that governs the extraction of that oil, who has access to that oil. And one major element of my project is looking at the ways in which Guatemala's hydrocarbon legislation oscillated between hegemony-driven policies, U.S. hegemony-driven policies that were, you know, ostensibly opening veins for foreign capital and the oligarchy in Guatemala. And on the other hand, nationalist policies that were Guatemalan-centered that put the extraction of Guatemalan oil to benefit Guatemalans. And that was carried out by both the Guatemalan right and the Guatemalan left at different times for different reasons and not particularly in unison. Now, the first 50 years of my story takes place before any substantial commercially viable oil has been discovered in Guatemala. So it's all just like a hypothetical. It's the potential and the prospect of Guatemalan oil that this push and pull over Guatemalan hydrocarbon legislation is over. People believed that Guatemala had major oil potential. It was rural. It was in the northern parts of Guatemala, northern, north central. And so that was the most remotest area of Guatemala and the hardest to access. There was no roads or infrastructure getting there. So it was one of those things that was kind of tabled for a future day. There was intermittent exploration from the teens to the 60s with nominal success, but a lot of potential was noted. And as Mexico took off, especially in their southern fields, the Chaco and Reforma fields in southern Mexico, Guatemala was increasingly pegged to be the next Kuwait or the next North Slope of Alaska if someone could just get in there and access the oil. There was this belief that it would drain the same geologic pond. So as early as the 19-teens, Washington leverages the government of Guatemala to put hydrocarbon legislation in place that benefits foreign capital. And they comply. And when Washington is trying to break into Middle Eastern oil, about a decade or so later, they're making the case that oil extraction should be and exploration should be competitive in the Middle East. And so you have this glaring contradiction in Latin America where the United States has sort of exclusive rights as if they were, Guatemala nationals to explore, oil in the region. And so the United States kind of backed off this contradiction. They said, you know what? Why don't we open Guatemala up to everybody legally in the spirit of free competition like we're pursuing elsewhere in the Middle East? Well, okay, fine. Except all the concessions, all the parcels had already been acquired. So you're opening the store up to all the customers, but there's nothing on the shelves. It was deceptive, to say the least. But generally speaking, Guatemalan oil was legally open for business for the American interests up until the Democratic Spring. After the Second World War, Guatemala increasingly adopts nationalistic hydrocarbon legislation that puts Guatemala in oil first. Again, no oil has been found of commercially viable, but it's Guatemalan potential. And there's a lot of American leverage to switch that up. And they respectfully declined. So I am definitely not saying that Guatemalan oil was the catalyst for the CIA coup in 1954, but it was part of the cocktail that drove Washington, to oppose the progressive Arbenz government at that time. Now, something to consider also is that after the Second World War, the United States commissioned a report called the Paley Commission. The government commissioned this report on minerals, critical resources, and which critical resources should be deemed umbrellaed under national security. And they concluded that critical resources were, in fact, fundamental to U.S. national security. And so the procurement of critical resources, controlling the global flow of critical resources, became U.S. national security. So despite all the altruism of the Cold War and alleged altruism of, promoting democracy and defeating authoritarianism, at the core of that, there was this belief that, American economic supremacy over critical resources globally was essential to U.S. national security. And then you've got to just, play several degrees of separation and you end up at the basic formula of American exceptionalism and innocence that, what's good for America is good for the world. Turns out not so much. And of course, the Global South, many people would have disagreed with that. But that was the general belief. And policymakers in Washington, scorned the self-determination of Global South states over their resources. I mean, Kennan basically said, to paraphrase, it drove him nuts that Global South nations had the audacity to think that those resources were theirs and not ours, just happened to be in their soil. So that's where we are at the start of the Cold War. And that creates sort of an intrinsic relationship between private oil companies and U.S. national security and the United States government. We don't have a national oil company here. There's no state oil. And so we have this intrinsic relationship with the private oil sector. And so the interests of international oil are the interests of U.S. national security, inherently so. So Cold War begins. Latin America's Cold War begins. There's the Arbenz coup, which ushers in right-wing governments, ostensibly leads to the beginning of the Guatemalan Civil War, which breaks out in 60 and continues till 1996. It's initially a rural war. It transitions to an urban war in the 70s and transitions back to a rural war in the early 80s, especially so, at which time it crossed the threshold of genocide when the Rios regime began indiscriminately targeting Guatemala's Mayan population. And it fades shortly thereafter, but continues up until 1996. I mean, there's a dirty war in the mid-80s as well. It just got a lot less press coverage, I guess. And so that's the state of the Guatemalan Civil War. And it's really brought to you by what Suzanne Jonas called the counterinsurgency state, basically brought to you by the United States a counterinsurgency apparatus that was just designed to sniff out communism and any elements of, you know, from teachers to labor organizers to, you know, indiscriminate minds, and suspend the rule of law when and where applicable. Dirty wars abound, that type of thing. And the entire Guatemalan counterinsurgency apparatus was installed by the United States in the 1960s through USAID and CIA and the State Department and that cast of characters. And that's what made it possible. As we moved into the 1970s, all of a sudden, they find oil in Guatemala. And the timing is perfect, right? Because you have the global oil crises, but the beginning in 1973, the global oil crisis, and the price of oil goes up. And this creates a unique situation for Guatemala because, again, it's a very rural place where the oil is suspected in the north. And so accessing that oil, getting it out of the ground, is expensive. And it has what we would say a high threshold for commercial viability. But when the global price of oil went up, all of a sudden, that threshold went down, and pursuing Guatemalan oil became a possibility. And so oil companies, by the mid-70s, there was a sincere interest in Guatemalan oil. Basic Resources, which was the primary company in Guatemala at that time, that was owned by, well, it had several owners by that time, one of which was Sir James Goldsmith, who was the a knighted international global capitalist. He owned everything from media to banks, and he wanted to try his hand in the oil industry. Basic Resources recycled oligarchs, Guatemalan oligarchs, through their administrative board. And to speak of Guatemalan oil at this time was to speak of Basic Resources, because they had really been the only consistent operation that was exploring. There was sporadic exploration in the past by larger oil companies, but Basic was the staple, and it was really the only true oil company that had been in Guatemala out at that time. And they found oil, and their first wells came online at Rubel Santo, and they built a pipeline. The mid-70s here, they built a pipeline to the Caribbean, and the area where they were to build the pipeline became known as the Zone of the Generals, because generals began acquiring that land, which people were living there, by the way, but they weren't afterward. And to build this pipeline, the generals acquired the land, and they began leasing or selling it to the pipeline to get the oil to market. Now, that's not to say that oil and development was the driving force behind a lot of the massacres that were taking place at this time, but it was part of that equation. Terence Kading wrote a piece on this back in the early 90s called The Economics of La Violencia. And he details the connection between development and dislocation and violence at this time. And he makes a very compelling case. I would certainly offer that anyone that was in the way of development certainly was dislocated. But I wouldn't detract from the sincerity of the military fervor to purge Guatemala of leftist elements anywhere that they thought they might be. So we find oil in the mid-70s, and international oil companies are flocking to Guatemala. The 1975 hydrocarbon legislation was changed by a right-wing military government in a more nationalistic direction, and it put Guatemalan interests first. The oligarchy were not fans of it, but it was that nationalistic streak within the military that made that happen. International oil companies that had deep pockets could swing it. Medium-sized oil companies had to form consortiums to go in and explore. That was the landscape that we see going into the 1980s, as a number of different exploratory operations in Guatemala at that time.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel, because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets, which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I guess the obvious question is, what happened with the oil? Why is Guatemala not an oil-producing nation today?
Yeah, and that is the question that whenever I talk about my research, people say, Guatemala, do they even have oil? And the truth of it is, yes and no. They are an oil exporting nation. They don't have a lot of it. Based on the best available technology at the time, there was a sincere belief that Guatemala was basically draining the same pond as Mexico's southern field would have been. Turns out, not so. So Guatemalan oil, it exists, but not in the quality nor quantity that everyone believed. And we found this out in the early 1980s. By 1981, 82, all these operations were coming up empty. Guatemala's hydrocarbon potential was over. It was a flop, which was unfortunate. Well, it was unfortunate for Guatemalans that they, you know, didn't have access to this resource. And the military government of Guatemala was kind of banking on some of that money to keep the regime and the war afloat. I mean, they were in financial dire straits at that time. But it turned out that the oil wasn't there. And as oil prices began to go down again, Guatemala's commercial viability threshold went back up. And we see less interest on the part of major international oil companies, medium-sized international oil companies. And they had taken great risk. I mean, the sincerity in Guatemalan oil, a number of scholars have sort of written off Guatemalan oil as an excuse used by the Reagan administration to pump money into aiding the Guatemalan regime, which, you know, I guess there was a time when people were so struggling with the cost of oil and so troubled by the oil crises that saying, we want to give them money because of the oil. I mean, I thought that was the quiet part, having, you know, come of age in the W. Bush administration and the Iraq War. But no, the Haig and the Reagan administration let it be known that you know, oil was one of those interests that was driving U.S. policy. So a lot of scholars, you know, quick to call Reagan out for being a warmonger in Central America, said, you know, they were exaggerating on the oil. And these are great scholars that have sort of reduced the significance of Guatemalan oil because there was none, you know, at the time that they were writing. But in fact, the evidence that people believed sincerely in Guatemalan oil is in the risk, is in the millions of dollars that companies like Texaco and some of the other consortiums doled out to try and find oil in Guatemala. There was a pretty sincere belief. I was lucky enough to interview a few people that were active in Latin American oil at the time, and the Ken Ledet, the project manager for Parker Drilling Company, which was doing the exploratory work for Texaco at the time. And the belief was sincere that they were going to get somewhere. And when they didn't, it was time to, you know, pack up and go somewhere else. But that belief came crashing down. I mean, you went from low-key eurekas, according to the New York Times in 1981, to a general abandonment by medium and large-size oil companies thereafter, which is where Charlie Wilson and the smaller oil companies come into play.
The presidency of Ronald Reagan was another important period in this story. He sought a closer relationship with Guatemala, and it was also around this time that the Kirkpatrick Doctrine emerged as well. So can you tell us a little bit about the shift in policy during the change from Carter to Reagan when it came to Guatemala?
Sure. So Gene Kirkpatrick was a political scientist, commentator, conservative political scientist in the United States. And she offered in a piece called Dictators and Double Standards, basically, in short, that right-wing dictators were more likely to transform into democracies than authoritarian Marxist governments, and therefore we should partner with our right-wing allies. And this was, you know, more or less reaffirming, kicking the can of what had become a U.S. policy of openly supporting right-wing dictators. You know, you can go back to the Mann Doctrine, which basically said that we should not judge our allies by their moral character, but by what they can do for us in terms of our national objectives. And then Rockefeller made a tour of Latin America, and in his report, he basically said, you know, these right-wing dictators are kind of work out pretty good for us. And by the mid-70s, we had been backing right-wing dictators wherever they could, anti-communist right-wing dictators. That was the number one key. If you were anti-communist, you know, you can get away, quite literally get away with murder, and we'd pay for it. So the Kirkpatrick Doctrine became sort of the ideological foundation for the Reagan administration at the start of the 80s, in 81. The Carter administration, Jimmy Carter had just passed away. Carter had allegedly made human rights the centerpiece of his foreign policy. You can find plenty of examples in which he did not do that. But in terms of Latin America and Central America, he did engage in nation building with the Salvadoran government at that time. But, you know, he was hard on Somoza in Nicaragua, and he was hard on the government of Guatemala. In fact, the Carter administration often gets credit for cutting off aid to Guatemala. But the story behind it's a little more nuanced. The State Department's human rights report said in the mid-70s, or start of the Carter administration, said that Guatemala had made some human rights improvement, but there was still work there to be done. And the nationalistic government there, which was fairly common, was appalled by the fact that they'd been killing communists just like they were told to do, just like they were following through on the counterinsurgency objectives that had been set up, you know, in that country with the help of the United States. And now all of a sudden they're in hot water for it. And you see this sentiment throughout Latin American regimes at this time, notably the Argentines as well. And so there was this belief that in Washington that we needed to partner with our right-wing allies, not abandon our right-wing allies among the conservative movement at that time. And so you have, you also have the Committee of Santa Fe, which, you know, published basically a call to arms for the hemisphere. It was entirely hyperbolic. It stated that, you know, Latin America was under communist attack. And of course, it was pretty much known that the Soviet Union respected the American sphere of influence. I mean, they might give money to certain groups, but far from establishing a Soviet beachhead in the hemisphere, like some of the hyperbolic claims of right-wing regimes, right-wingers in Washington would claim. And so there's this neoconservative movement to abandon Carter's commitment to human rights and to partner with our right-wing allies again. And this is what Reagan carries with him into the 1980s. And when it came to Guatemala, Reagan was enthusiastic about restoring relations with the anti-communist, so much so that the Bureau of Human Rights had said under Reagan, and basically under Elliot Abrams' leadership, said that Guatemala had made human rights improvement, when in fact the opposite had happened. I mean, they were committing genocide by 1982. And Elliot Abrams said, no, they're making improvements. Eventually, by 1982-ish, Reagan went into his presidency guns ablaze that human rights were naive and that we needed to have a realistic take on the Cold War and rebuild relations with our right-wing allies. Reagan learned quickly that Congress wasn't having it, and he had to adopt some semblance of a human rights commitment or policy. And so you see the emergence of a quote-unquote conservative human rights policy. And Elliot Abrams, who was sort of the initial author of this, the Abrams memo, when he was a lowly staffer, was leaked, published in the New York Times, claiming that we needed to make hard choices with our allies when they engaged in human rights abuses, but we still needed to wage the Cold War and challenge Soviet encroachments wherever it turned out to be, wherever we can imagine them or make them up. So Reagan, what he did was he moved the goalpost on human rights. Now, people will say that Reagan had a turnaround on human rights or, you know, a rights revolution. All he did was change the definition of human rights to accommodate pre-existing U.S. Cold War policy. He basically, you know, redefined human rights as democracy promotion. So not economic rights and the rights of individuals to be free from abject poverty, but rather the rights of private capital and democracy promotion, which became the foundation of the DEMPRO theorists in the modern era that were all too keen to write off any U.S. intervention under the auspices of democracy promotion. And that became a bipartisan trend. So this new conservative human rights agenda, it's not fooling anybody in Washington, but it changes the rhetoric and it enables the administration to come up with its own discourse, its own narrative on what's happening in certain states where they would like to pursue certain policies. And in doing so, it enables the administration to exercise executive discretion, like in the case of Guatemala, and say, we think they're making human rights improvements. And so we want to give them aid. And this is what played out in the early 1980s as the administration tried to cough up more aid. And it ultimately became one of the linchpins that eroded human rights provisions in foreign assistance legislation in the first place. So if you wonder how we go from Section 502B of the Foreign Assistance Act that prohibits aiding gross human rights violators and having congressional hearings about that in the 70s and 80s to openly dumping millions of dollars to genocidal regimes today, if you're wondering how we got there, it starts with Reagan's evasions and circumventions of human rights provisions in foreign assistance legislation. And Guatemalan oil ties into the story.
And you mentioned Charlie Wilson earlier. Some listeners might have heard of the film from 2007, Charlie Wilson's War, which was about him as a congressman and his involvement in the Afghan war against the Soviet Union. I didn't know before reading the thesis that he plays quite a prominent role in Guatemala as well. So what was he doing there?
Sure. So Texas Congressman Charlie Wilson, Democratic congressman, but very much a hawkish Democrat, very much a cold warrior. Wilson, as you mentioned, earned notoriety for arming the Afghan Mujahideen, which eventually became the Taliban, which backfired, obviously. He was also a friend to Somoza's in Congress. He was an ardent supporter of Somoza. In fact, at one point in time when the Carter administration was going to give Somoza an ultimatum to step down, he sent Bureau of Human Rights Director Patricia Darien there, and along with the ambassador, they were going to give Somoza this ultimatum. And when they got there, sitting across from them already was Charlie Wilson and another senator or congressman who I can't recall off the top of my head. And they backed Somoza to the point that they didn't deliver the ultimatum. They just had a stern talking to, I guess. But that was derailed. So Wilson was on the side of right-wing dictators, right-wing anti-communist dictators, wherever they may be. And such was the case in Guatemala. Wilson comes from an oil region of Texas. All of Texas is an oil region of Texas. And he represents not only people drilling oil in Texas, but refineries, industries that manufacture parts for extraction, exploration, development, and so on. A very interconnected industry. And these are small-time players. So Wilson, of course, works for anyone all of Texas oil, but obviously especially his constituents. And American oil had a good year, but Reagan began proposing windfall profits taxes on domestic oil. And this put the oil industry in a frenzy. And so Wilson conceived of the idea. I'm not sure who conceived of the idea of pursuing Guatemalan oil. The government of Guatemala certainly invited Wilson to come and visit in an unsanctioned visit in 1982, summer of 1982, which is peak genocide, peak violence in the Rios regime's genocide. And Wilson is seeking to make contacts and explore the possibility of letting some of his small-time oil players get access to Guatemalan oil. He goes down to Guatemala in the summer of 82 with unidentified extractive industry reps, and he meets with Rios's cabinet, and they discuss the possibility of liberalizing Guatemala's hydrocarbon legislation to make it more accessible to small and medium-sized players like those in Wilson's district. And the extractive industry reps make presentations. Basically, Guatemala is the first southerly stop from Texas to drill oil. Mexico, state-owned oil company, off limits to foreign investors. Unless you're contracted to perform specific functions for the state oil industry. But in terms of going in and wildcatting, that was off the table in Mexico. So Guatemala is the first southerly stop. And so Wilson also, while he's there, tours sort of a potemkin village of Guatemalan sites where there was alleged massacres. And he meets villagers. He's accompanied by the Guatemalan military, and he does sort of a human rights inspection on his own, completely unsanctioned. And he chats with Rios, and then he goes home. And what's left on the table is sort of this quid pro quo agreement that government of Guatemala is going to liberalize its hydrocarbon legislation, and Wilson is going to do what he can to open up avenues of foreign assistance for the government of Guatemala. That was another thing that they had discussed at length, was the various forms of aid opportunities for the government of Guatemala. Because again, Carter had suspended, I think I failed to touch on this before, Carter had suspended aid to Guatemala, but it didn't actually happen that Carter was the one that cut the cord. They gave a critical human rights report of the government of Guatemala at the time, and they were sort of appalled that there was any room for improvement because they were carrying out a counterinsurgency war as, you know, they were designed to do with Washington's assistance. So they said, we don't want any aid from you if it comes with contingencies that we're supposed to alter anything. This really irked the nationalists in the Guatemalan government. So they refused the aid. Now, you know, didn't really work out to their favor because they were in dire financial straits. They were going way into debt by the start of the 80s. The Lucas regime was borrowing quite heavily to fund all these development projects, which were tied to various massacres and dislocations. And that's when Rios took office. And Rios sort of wanted to stabilize the economy, did not, got worse. But back to Wilson. Wilson and the Rios government make this deal. And then Wilson goes home to the States and immediately begins promoting the government of Guatemala in the media, begins denying the human rights accusations, claiming that, you know, they were making human rights improvements, that the Rios regime was committed to human rights. And this was right in line with the Reagan administration's narrative, who was trying to open up avenues of aid to the government of Guatemala, saying that the Rios regime was making human rights improvements. And that was really the strategy. I mean, they wanted to say, whenever somebody new came into power, the idea was that we can just utilize executive discretion, say they're making improvements, and get them a bunch of money before the truth comes out. And that's what the Reagan administration was trying to do under Rios. Unfortunately, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, they were on it already. And there was plenty of evidence to the contrary. So Wilson goes before Congress, congressional subcommittee hearing on a Inter-American Development Bank, IADB, telecommunications package for Guatemala, something to the tune of $16 million. And this package was rejected in 1981 because of human rights violations. But the State Department pushed it again in 1982. Now, unlike U.S. money, U.S. congressional funds, this is an international lending institution. And so it doesn't fall under 502B of the Foreign Assistance Act. It falls under 701 of the International Financial Institutions Act that says that you can't provide aid to gross human rights violators. And the U.S. representative at the time is expected to vote no on the package for gross human rights violators. And the U.S. has what I would call influential primacy in some of these institutions, kind of like the U.N. Security Council. If the U.S. votes no, it's dead in the water. But if Washington abstains, That's sort of a cue that says to our right-wing allies who are hooked on American debt, hooked on American aid, it says, we can't approve this, wink, wink, but you should go ahead and approve it for us if we abstain. So that's how Pinochet got nearly $1 billion out of Washington over the years. You know, we threw Pinochet under the bus in the press. Elliot Abrams did anyway, but at the same time, gave him hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, Max, I don't know about you, but if I said you were a terrible person and I gave you $1 billion, I don't think you would believe me. That was the situation with Pinochet, in my opinion. So anyway, back to this congressional hearing. So Wilson is before Congress, a congressional subcommittee that is reviewing this package that's been resubmitted for Guatemala. And Stephen Bosworth from the State Department and one other delegate are there. And they're making the case that the Rios government has made human rights improvements. And Wilson testifies before Congress that he was there firsthand, mostly Democrats in the subcommittee, and he saw for himself with his own eyes. And he's not really fooling anybody, but he makes the case on behalf of the Guatemalan government. In the end, the subcommittee, I mean, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International also testified their firsthand victim accounts as well. But the State Department left before they could give their presentation. They said their piece and left, as did Wilson. So the subcommittee said, we're not going to approve this because clearly they are gross and consistent human rights violations taking place. But the Reagan administration went ahead with it anyway. They exercised executive discretion and said, well, we believe that they're making human rights improvements. Elliot Abrams at the State Department, the Bureau of Human Rights, was willing to back it up. And they went ahead, they abstained, but the package was approved. And I go into detail in my research on how embedded the telecommunications sector is in Guatemala to the counterinsurgency state. And it would be an exercise in naivety to presume that this money didn't go through military channels towards various elements of counterinsurgency. And at the time where they were setting up model villages, which were, you know, akin to, they were called concentration camps by a number of onlookers. In the Scorched Earth campaign that was taking place in Guatemala, they would pretty much tell people, if you're not in one of these camps, you're an enemy and we're going to shoot you. And so then they ended up in those camps. Now, Wilson and others would argue that these were, you know, happy places. History and facts reveal otherwise. So yeah, so that was Wilson's role. I mean, Wilson, he tried to broker this oil deal, and he testified before Congress, and he lived up to his end of the bargain, the aid for oil bargain that he had reached with the government of Guatemala. Now, and it wasn't, of course, it wasn't just the telecommunications package. It was opening new channels of aid. Less successful with that during Rios's tenure. But on the Guatemalan end, they lived up to their end of the bargain eventually. Hydrocarbon legislation was opened up to foreign investment again in 1983, but Rios was out by then. It was yet another coup. Rios had toyed with the idea of nationalizing or forming a state oil company. It was not well received. He walked it back rather quickly, and he never got around to changing hydrocarbon legislation. It was changed in 1983, but by then it was a moot point. Wilson had managed to get the Windfall Profits Act off the table through sheer political wizardry. He managed to get enough people in Congress to wash their hands of it. And so the Windfall Profits Tax didn't go through. Domestic oil industry people were once again happy, and Wilson kind of averted his gaze to Guatemalan oil in that moment. So I guess in terms of liberalizing Guatemalan hydrocarbon legislation, it came too little too late. By the time they had sort of reopened their veins, the major interest in Guatemalan oil had passed. You know, Wilson wasn't looking on behalf of major oil industries. He was looking for little guys to pick up the table scraps of the major oil industries that didn't want to be there. They were leaving at the time. So it was too little too late for Guatemala in liberalizing their hydrocarbon legislation. There was continued exploration, and in terms of location, you know, 90% of the oil in Guatemala does come from the northern Petén region where they thought it was going to be, but it's not much at all now. I think last I checked, there was a French company named Perenco that was operating most of the oil in the country at that time. Basic Resources called it quits. I think they chugged along for a few years, but Goldsmith got out of the oil game and it sort of fizzled. And Guatemalan oil, it never lived up to its potential and became sort of an afterthought. But returning to Wilson and that circumvention of human rights provisions and foreign assistance legislation, the Reagan administration, you know, that was sort of a key moment in chipping away at human rights provisions and foreign assistance legislation. It's one of those moments that got us where we are today. And so that's something that I do emphasize in my research, this tiny little telecommunications package. Who knew? Watershed moment for the erosion of human rights law, human rights provisions and foreign assistance legislation anyway.
So I guess we've looked at a lot of the big characters. We've talked about Charlie Wilson and presidents, politicians, big industry. Just wondering if you'd be able to give a bit of a overview of how all of this affected the ordinary Guatemalan through the civil war, oil, the oil explorations. What was the impact for ordinary people of all this?
Good question. It was believed in the 1970s and into the early 1980s that Guatemala would become energy self-sufficient and become a major exporter of oil. This was based on the best technology at the time. Even into the mid-80s, the U.S. intelligence documents revealed that they still believed that there was oil in the ground. Just the commercial viability threshold was up pretty high, too high to really make it worth anyone's interest. But there was this belief that Guatemala would become energy independent and an energy exporter. And unfortunately, that didn't play out. And so who's to say the Guatemalan people are unfortunately out this potential and all that and could come of it, which is, unfortunate. But how did it affect everyday Guatemalans? I'll again defer to the Terence Kading article, The Economics of La Violencia, about the relationship between development and violence. And my earlier comments on the zone of the generals in the FTN, there was a direct correlation between development initiatives and rural violence in the 1970s and the 1980s. Would there have been rural violence in that time anyway? Absolutely. Would it have happened in the exact same place where they wanted to put a pipeline? I mean, probably, maybe, I don't know. Not really a major part of the counterinsurgency operations that were taking place in the late 70s and early 80s. But again, certainly part of it. In terms of oil operations on the ground, we have different reports that some workers were paid poorly. There were worker protests that they were not being paid the minimum wage for the oil companies. I think Texaco or Shell might have been one of the recipients of some of that criticism. That should not be surprising that a foreign multinational extractive industry is shortchanging the locals. And there has since been a number of studies on the ecological impact of the oil industry and the social and cultural impact on indigenous groups throughout Guatemala. That's, again, pretty much a staple of the industry. Wherever you're going to set up shop, I think you're going to find that. And Guatemala was no exception.
So normally at the end of these interviews, if we're talking about a book that's been published, I'll mention it. Obviously, this is based on your thesis. So I was wondering if you had any plans to publish it or into it in a book form or anything similar?
Yeah, I'm shopping publishers right now. I'm not going to kiss and tell, but I'm in contact. You know, I don't want to jinx it. So I am in contact. And then, you know, as these things go, whatever doesn't make the book, I'll try and put into press somewhere else. We'll see what happens.
Well, thank you for coming on. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been great. And thanks for doing what you do. I enjoy the podcast. I recommend it to my students last term, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. That's very nice to hear.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel, because right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets, which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.